Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is noted guitar player Pete Thorne. But first, let's talk about streaming music subscriptions. Believe it or not, the sales were going through the roof, and all of a sudden, they've plateaued. According to the new Nielsen Music 360 study, and this is a report that comes out every year about this time, they found out that a lot of people are subscribing, but they're not subscribing to the paid tier. And this is very, very troubling. First of all, they asked, why are you not willing to pay? And there are three answers that came back. The first one was that, well, it's too expensive. The second answer was, you know what? You can stream a lot already for free. And the third answer was, I just can't justify the spend, especially if I don't listen all that much. So let's look at all three of these. The first one, too expensive. Well, guess what? Just about every music industry pundit, just about every advisor and consultant has said already that $9.99 a month is too high. And ideally, it should be $3.99 or $4.99. And that way, there'd be a lot more people who'd be willing to subscribe. Now, not only would they be willing to pay to stream, they'd also be a little less leery about not listening so much one month. So in other words, if they only listened for an hour in one particular month because they were so busy, they wouldn't feel like they lost a lot of money. Now, even though 10 bucks isn't a lot of dough, there's a price resistance point where you might say, wait a second, okay, maybe this isn't worth it. At $3.99, you probably won't say that. So there's a big price problem that's happening in the streaming music world. Who's responsible for this? Well, guess what? It's mostly the major record labels. They dictate the price. When Apple tried to actually bring out a price that was much less at $7.99, they got so much resistance that they couldn't do it. Basically, it wasn't resistance. It was, no, we won't allow you to do this. So this is a big, big problem in the music industry. It looks like it's not going to get better as well, because one of the other questions in Music 360 was, how likely do you think it will be that you'll purchase a paid subscription in the next year? And a full 78% said they were very unlikely to do so. So this could really throw a spanner in the works here in terms of subscription music and its growth. Now, all the numbers keep on saying that everything is growing. There's more money coming in. Yes, that's true. But the growth has definitely slowed, and it's all because of price. So keep an eye out on this story, because it's going to be major and it's going to be even more intense over the next few months. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 mixing tricks, big studio tricks for the small studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is something that surprised everybody, and that's the resurgence of cassette tapes. Yes, you heard me right. Cassette tapes are selling again. How much are they selling? Well, guess what? There is one plant last year, and it's the biggest plant that's doing cassette replication, and they alone sold 10 million. Let's put that into perspective. Last year, the vinyl resurgence was only responsible for 14 million vinyl record albums, and this one plant did 10 million cassettes alone. The breakout of these numbers is even more interesting, because 70% of that 10 million, 7 million was actually allocated to Sony and Warner Brothers. So Sony and Warner Brothers, two of the three major labels, are actually still in the cassette business. You thought it went away, but it really didn't. Now let's take this one more step here. The resurgence of cassettes is such that TIAC Tascam is actually coming out with not a new line of cassette players, but they're reintroducing their old line of cassette players. So one of the big problems about cassettes is you couldn't find a player, but guess what? Pretty soon you'll be able to. So look out for that, because that's pretty interesting. The fact that all of a sudden we have not one Left 4 Dead format coming back in vinyl records, but we also have cassettes as well. My guest today is the excellent session and touring guitar player Pete Thorne. Pete's played with superstars like Don Henley, Chris Cornell, and Melissa Etheridge. He also has a monthly column in Premier Guitar Magazine called Tone Tips from the Road. He gives some awesome video lessons and gear demos, and it was just great to speak with him again. Here's Pete from his home in Los Angeles. So, who have you been playing with lately?
Well, I've been over in Japan 6 of the last 12 months. I've been touring with a Japanese artist, so his name is Kiyoshi Nagabuchi.
Wow.
And that's taken up most of my time as far as touring goes. So I was with him, summer tour last summer I did, and then we went back in late winter in February and sort of early spring and did another couple months over there, a spring tour, and then I went back in May and back again in June, and then I went back for the end of June for all the way through to August 24th. And that was all basically that last trip I did was preparation for one show. And then finally we did this big show in the, at Fuji for like 100,000 people. Wow. And it was like an all night concert. So people say, why were you there all summer for like one show? And it's because it was like a 9-hour event. So, we did like 4 sets and took short breaks in between. We just kind of played all night through till the sun came up. So
did you repeat any songs?
Production. No, nothing like that. No. Actually, we actually had to cut songs. We actually ran out. Kiyoshi likes to extend songs and do, long jams and stuff like that and stretch things out and whatnot. And, he tells lots of stories and stuff. He's been around for years and Japanese love him. So he's like a, almost like a folk hero there or something, or like an icon, in that country. As far as, he's an interesting combination of like a singer-songwriter type artist, but also a rock artist. He started out in the '70s, like with an acoustic guitar and singing songs like that. And then he went way more rock later on in his career. So the '80s and the '90s. And so he's got both sides. So,
does he only do Japan or the rest of Asia?
Mainly Japan. There's been some talk of that, like maybe at some point, you'd investigate going to other places, but not yet. So, it's mainly been Japan for Kiyoshi.
What gear did you use? Did you take gear with you, or was it supplied to you over there?
I basically took everything. The first run I did over there, I used some rented cabinets, which ended up being my cabinets anyway, like my PT-100 cabinets. So there were some people over there that had PT-100 cabs, and they were gracious enough to let us rent them. So I did that for the first little while, but then in this past run, I ended up just bringing my own.
What's your rig like?
Basically, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, what's your rig like these days?
Guitar-wise, it's a whole mishmash of things, just because I feel like I need a lot of different sounds, everything from Telecaster through to, Strat, to a kind of hot rod Strat, to hollow body tones, to Les Pauls. So it's just like a kind of mix of, of Gibson and Gibson style guitars, Fender and Fender style guitars. I'm using a lot of Sur guitars. And so that's kind of, just a lot of different tones and stuff like that I need to cover. Started using some Takamine acoustics, because JSU's hooked up with Takamine, and they supplied us with some beautiful guitars to use over there. So that was great. As far as amps go, it's the PT-100 from Sur, and I had a stereo PT-100 setup going over there, similar to what I've been doing for kind of like maybe the past 4 years. I just took my main pedal board, which is, a handful of different drives and a compressor and stuff like that. And then I've got some Strymon and stuff on there, like the Timeline and Mobius, and then 2 Eventide H9s.
Okay. I've been watching your blog and your website and your YouTube channel and everything, and you're big on guitar tone, which is very cool because a lot of people don't spend as much time on that as I think they should, and you probably feel the same way. Do you feel that most of your tone comes from the guitar and amp combination? How big a part do the pedals play for you?
Well, you want to start with a good basis, like guitar and amp wise, and that sort of colors everything, right? I mean, depending on the amp you use, some pedals tend to have a homogenizing effect on the guitar tone, I guess. Can't really tell maybe if you're playing a Strat or a Tele or something when you turn on certain fuzzes or something. But for the most part, the guitar you play and the amp you play through will have a huge impact on the overall tone. So you want to kind of like, I find guys, maybe the biggest sort of, misconceptions or where there's a lack of knowledge is like, with certain drives and fuzzes and things like that into certain amps, depending on the circuit of the amp, it can sound just vastly different. So, if you're hitting an amp that has a fairly, what I call a neutral clean sound, it's sort of really balanced. And I would maybe use the example of, anything that doesn't have a bright cap or a bright switch on, just kind of a neutral clean. Sometimes I use the example of a normal channel of an AC30.
Oh, right.
Whatever class A thing going on and whatnot, but the normal channel has a kind of very sort of standard sound to it. It's not, top boosted or anything like that. If you use a channel like that, certain drives and things are going to work really, really well. Actually, the majority of drives and fuzzes and things like that will sound great into sort of a neutral clean that doesn't have too much top end boosted or anything like that. If you have a more of a scooped sound going on, or use an amp with that has a bright cap or a bright switch that you like to run on and whatnot, it's going to be way, way more finicky and picky when it comes to drives and pedals and things like that you're putting into it. So that's one thing that I find, where it's like, you want to kind of be aware, I guess, what your sort of core clean tone is, what you're comfortable with, what you like. And if using pedals and whatnot is an important thing, then you kind of want to pick pedals that'll work well with the type of design that you're starting off with, as far as like, your core sort of clean tone. I don't know if that's the answer you're looking for.
I mean, what I found is there's a lot of guys players that rely so much on their pedals that that's their sound. Mm-hmm. But again, it's, you picked the perfect word and you said homogenized. Everything starts to sound the same at that point.
I think that the core, the tones back in the day when there was less pedals and people were deriving their main guitar tones from just cranking amps up, and the amps didn't have preamp based gain, and they were just like a non-master volume affair, be it a Marshall Plexi or an old Fender or an AC30 or whatever. A lot of the amp and guitar character really came through then. Players were using more of the volume controls on the guitar or whatever for different, levels of gain or clean and dirty. You really hear a guitar and amp combo, for some reason when it's just like a purity of tone thing, I guess. Now when amps started getting sort of more preamp gain based and whatnot, that can have somewhat of a homogenizing effect. And then as soon as you start putting a lot of pedals and things into it, well, it can sort of be, could be a number of different amps at that point. They become sort of hard to identify just by hearing. So not that that's a bad thing or anything. It's like, the most important thing is that it's an appropriate sound for whatever the song you're playing. Or the part. That's the most important thing. So I think we're back to a place now where it's kind of like, certainly with the PT100, because it's a master volume design and a multi-channel amp, but we're trying to, at least, in my amp, and I think other amp manufacturers feel the same way, that it's trying to get, some really organic, and soulful kind of tones, maybe with some more modern designs. So
how did the combination of you and Sir come about? Because there's a signature guitar now, right? You have a signature guitar with
you. No, not really. A lot of people saw me with this black guitar with two of my signature. I have a signature pickup with Sir now called the Thornbucker. Lower output PAF style set of humbuckers that we did. So we made a guitar that I wanted to, I sort of envisioned in my head, I had this guitar in mind to sort of show off the pickups, and I thought it would be really cool. And so they made me this guitar, and a lot of people said, oh, is that going to be your signature model? And not really. Sir doesn't really actually do, signature models at this point. For a while they had the Guthrie Govan guitar and whatnot, but what they do like to do is do like an artist spec. So, for instance, you can order a Sir Classic that is the Scott Henderson spec. So with the neck shape he likes and the pickup he likes to use and whatnot, but it's not the Scott Henderson model. It's just like Scott Henderson specs Sir Classic. So I would say the same thing goes, you know, for my guitar. They put that guitar up online. They made a little webpage for it, and there's a spec sheet. You can call Sir and say, I want a guitar like, you know, that Pete Thorne Black Sir Standard, and they'll know exactly what you're talking about, and you can get one like that. But, you know, they just, for whatever reason, they just decided that, you know, maybe specific artist models isn't something that they want to do. And so I understand that. And also, I play, you know, on my end, I play a ton of different guitars. Like I was saying on Tsuyoshi's gig, I need, you know, Strats and Tellys and, you know, Les Pauls and all kinds of different things. So it's like, it sort of doesn't make sense for me to have a signature guitar at this point, since in the course of being a side guy and doing sessions and stuff like that, it's like, I need a lot of different instruments, I think.
Yeah, kind of limits you, I guess. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so your original question, though, was how did my relationship with them come about? And it was actually very organic. I bought a used Sir Classic from a guy in the East Coast, and he sent it to me. And I bought it, you know, sight unseen or whatever, just through over a classifieds in the gear page, actually. I'd heard a lot about John's guitars, and I just wanted to check one out. There was a good price on one. So I ordered it, and I got it, and I pulled that guitar out of the case, and I started playing it when I got it at my house. And I thought, God, that's a nice guitar. It plays great. It's very resonant. And I played it for about 45 minutes, just unplugged. And I realized after 45 minutes that I'd never tuned it. I just pulled it out of a case and traveled cross country. Wow. And it was in tune, and it was still in tune. I went like, oh, this is a really good guitar. Super solid. It just, you know, and, I used that guitar in some of my very, very, very early videos throughout my YouTube channel. It's like a sort of a blue, Sir Classic. I wish I still had it, actually. I don't have it anymore. I have an equally nice one that's a Sunburst, and I have a white one and some different guitars. But anyway, that's how it started. And so I can't remember how I originally contacted them, but I got in touch with the company at some point, and then they said, hey, we've got amps and pedals and all kinds of stuff we're doing. Maybe you want to check them out. And I think I drove out there one day and stopped in, and I met John and, you know, met the other guys at the shop, and they were just extremely nice people. And John and I ended up, you know, sort of seeing eye to eye on a lot of things when it comes to guitars and tone and just in general. And he's one of my best friends at this point. So it was just a very cool, natural, organic thing. They got one of the original Badger 18 amps into my hands, and I did a video for it. Just kind of thought, oh, I'll just sort of they give me a nice price, like an artist price on it. And I thought, I'll do a nice video for these guys as a thank you. And that video blew up really big. I put it up on my YouTube channel, and people seemed to really like it. And it's kind of one of the first gear demo things that I can ever remember seeing. Like, I don't think I'd ever watched specifically at that point, like a video gear demo of anything. And I don't know, I just thought, well, maybe I'll try and record this amp really well and explain what it does and put it up on my YouTube channel. And that really took off. So kind of a combination of different things happened. You know, my relationship with Sir started, and me making these guitar-oriented gear videos kind of also started around that time.
Well, speaking of videos, you've been really big into that on a couple different levels, both the gear and also your lessons that you've been doing. So how did that all come about?
I just decided when I had some downtime, I thought maybe I can make some guitar lessons for folks and see what they think. Actually, a friend of mine had asked me, hey, can you show me how to play this song and that song? We could never get together. So I ended up making some simple videos and just said, here's some videos I made for you so that you can see how to do these songs that you want to learn how to play. And then I thought, well, I've got these videos anyway, I might as well put them up on my YouTube channel. So I've got a video up from way, way back when that are like, you know, an accurate lesson on how to play Blackbird and an accurate lesson on how to play Paranoid Android by Radiohead and some of these songs that I thought I couldn't at the time anyway find like some very good lessons that show how to actually play those songs accurately. So I thought these would be useful to somebody. And those videos, they really, you know, just took off, and they've got hundreds of thousands of views now. So, I need to do more lessons, to tell you the truth. I don't have that many up, but the one thing I did do that became very popular was a five-part video lesson series on how to play Eruption.
Yeah.
And that was something I just thought, well, I can, you know, I learned it, and I can play it, and I spent a lot of time on trying to figure out all the, you know, just like on a guitar sort of very nerdy level, trying to figure out the intricacies and the, you know, how to play it accurately. with the right swing and the right feel and stuff. So I made a video series on that, and that also became very popular. Then a guy came up to me in, I tell the story sometimes, but a guy came up to me at one point when I was on tour with Chris Cornell in 2009. Those videos had been up for about a year, and he came up to me on the street in Lisbon, Portugal, and he said, "You taught me how to play Eruption." And I went like, "Wow, that's really cool." Yeah. And, you know, here I am in Europe, and a light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, this is really powerful. This is a cool thing. And, you know, ever since then, it kind of got me thinking more about things I can do as a musician in this day and age independently, where I can reach a lot of people and I don't need anybody else to do it. You know, yeah. I can sit and create something, be it a song, and sell it over the internet, or a video lesson and, you know, get that out over the internet. And these are all things we can do these days without any kind of, help. You just need incentive. You know, you just need to be a self-starter and get yourself up in the morning and say, what am I going to do? And maybe, I don't know, we'll make a 5-part How to Play Eruption series and see what happens. And all of a sudden, you know, it gets out there, and it's just really it's amazing, you know, really, this day and age. The internet drives me crazy too, you know, like probably with everybody. And I think we're all, you know, stuck in our phones and, you know, too distracted by it and stuff like that. And we could all probably stand to spend a little more time like in the real world. But by the same token, it's amazing. So it's maddening, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I did the same thing where I started to do online courses. And first I started doing them for lynda.com, which were great. Mm-hmm. And then I decided to do some myself. And it's been very cool. I got to say, it's been a lot of fun. And it feels really good. It, you know, as you say, when someone, you know, gets in touch with you or you meet someone and says, you taught me how to do that, you know, thank you. Nothing better than that.
Yeah. There's nothing better than that. And it's so direct and easy. And there was no middleman, so to speak, or anybody, you know, with, you know, you can do these things and just put them out there, and people love that. They love authenticity, and they love when you give back. And lately I started this question and answer series on my YouTube channel, where people ask me questions about anything guitar related, music related, career related, that kind of thing. And you know, on my Facebook, people have been sending me a bunch of emails, and then I'll just put up a video where I just answer questions. And that's a great thing, you know. It's just like people seem to really dig it, and they appreciate it. You know, when you take time out of your day to do something, if you've got something that you can offer someone, I think, and you're not, you know, asking for anything for it, or you know, and you just put it out there, it really goes a long way. I think you make sort of lifelong fans that way, or people just tune in and they're like, hey, this guy's got something to offer, and he's showing me something, and they seem to really appreciate it. So. That's a really cool thing.
You're not monetizing your videos, are you?
I have I have like the standard sort of, you know, Google ads on my videos. The Google partner, I'm a part of that.
Yeah.
But some of them I do, and some of them I don't. You know, it just depends. I make a lot of videos for a terrific store called Vintage King.
Oh yeah, sure.
And, and I do gear videos for them, and I don't monetize those, and certain ones I don't. It seems like, well, you know, I'm producing a video that's supposed to be something, you know, for them. And it doesn't seem like something that would be appropriate for me to have some ad on. So you can kind of pick per video, but yeah, I will. If it's, you know, I think nobody's getting rich off their, monetization of YouTube videos, unless you've got, you know, 500,000 subscribers and you're getting a ton of video views for every video, then there's some real money in it. But it, every little bit helps, and it's kind of a cool thing that's out there. You know?
I'm doing an update to my Music 4.0 book right now, and I'm trying to track down where every thousandth of a cent goes from streams, you know, be it from Spotify or Pandora or YouTube. And it's very interesting when you really get into it and you start to track things down. You find out there's more money being made, but there's more fingers in the pie in between. So it's the same as it ever was, in a way, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure it must be fascinating, you know? I'll have to check that out when you get that all done. I want to see that. That'd be some interesting perspective, I'm sure, that you'll have on where all that's going.
Well, I'll make sure you get a copy. then.
Terrific, yeah.
Tell me about your solo album.
Well, the solo album was really fun. It's actually time for another one. So I'm thinking on that now. I got to get started. And I maybe have some time now to do that. But the first one, I brought it out in 2011. Really, I worked on it for years. I mean, there's songs on there that I started in 2005. And there's actual parts that, you know, that were made it onto the record from way back then. And then I would come back to songs, you know, years later and maybe say, oh, this is kind of a cool thing. And then just build around what I had and finish it. Once again, it was one of those things where it was like, well, this is something that I can obviously do now and I don't need anyone else to do it. I have a studio. I'm getting good sounds. It's easy to distribute something yourself and I'm just going to kind of record this thing and put it out and it'll be a statement. And sort of the theme was like, this is who I am. I put the dumbest picture I could find of myself on the cover when I'm like 10 years old. I went to Sears with my first guitar and you know, had my mom, you know, yeah. Get me some photos. It's my first photo shoot. Let's take some photos. I think we were going to do family photos. And I said, Mom, can I take my guitar and get some pictures or something? You know, so the guy shot, you know, five, you know, snapshots of me with my guitar or whatever. And that ended up being my album cover all those years later. So, and sort of with the concept of being, this is who I am. I'm this guitar obsessed guy that has been ever since I was a little kid and got my first guitar, and I'm a geek about it. And also, so sort of, you know, there was a tie in there musically where it's like the songs I put on there, I just didn't worry about being cool or current or whatever. You know, I was just like, this is who I am at this point. I'm just going to write songs that I feel like writing and put them on this record. And be very honest about it, not try and fit in. I think I'd spent so many years, sort of navigating the music business and, you know, in bands, trying to get record deals or whatever. You get the deal and you're maybe trying to, you know, please people for the wrong reasons, write hits or, just getting a deal. You're trying to put on a good show for the label, doing label showcases, and you're up there jumping around, like trying to impress people or something. And I think all those years of doing all that stuff, just culminated in me just saying, screw it. This is my album. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And if anybody else wants to listen, that's great. And if not, that's okay too. So that was what Guitar Nerd was all about.
It's liberating, huh?
Totally liberating. Yeah, totally liberating. And that's the great thing about the internet age. And, you know, what I'm saying is it's like, it's maddening because I sometimes wish I could just not do it and take a break and, just play my guitar or whatever. But by the same token, it's totally liberating and gives you power and really lets you be yourself in so many ways. My girlfriend Trisha was telling me that, she's been reading a lot of marketing books and things lately. And, she was telling me about this one book she was reading where, they were saying basically that you don't have to connect with a gajillion people out there. You just need to have your little tribe, the people that are into whatever you're into. And I think we see that these days where it's like, whatever is on the MTV VMAs or whatever's reflected out there and sort of what it, you know, the mainstream popular culture or whatever, what we see in the magazines and stuff like that. You don't necessarily have to be a part of any of that in order to have, you know, your little tribe and your little world and have your, however many, anywhere from a few hundred to, you know, hopefully several thousand people or whatever it is that are into your music and will come to your shows and check out your stuff and be a fan. And that, so everything's kind of all fragmented and splintered, but it's like kind of a good thing, you know, I think.
Yeah.
What I mean? Like where it's like, you know, there's bands that are out there playing big shows or decent sized shows or theaters or whatever they're doing. And they're not anything that you see in popular culture these days.
Yeah.
Like reflected in magazines or whatever's at MTV and AMAs or whatever. It's like, there's bands that have their tribe and their thing and, you know, they can go and tour and do it on their level and stuff and keep it small, but keep it all, you know? So.
Well, as someone who I really respect once told me recently, making a living is the new success. Makes
right.
A lot of
yeah,
sense.
I like
you know?
That.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah.
Because
it's like as long as it's working out and you're paying the bills, you know, and you're happy, right? You know.
I mean, we both went through the era where, you know, you're trying to get the big record deal and, you know, doing whatever you can, prostituting yourself to some degree to get it. And as you say, trying to please probably the wrong people in doing it. And in the meantime, you're not doing what you really like to do, you know, really, or love to do. So that's why those people that you're talking about that are playing, you know, and have 1,000 fans, you know, the 1,000 fan theory, they're probably a whole lot happier about things and making much better music, I would think.
Yeah, well, it'll drive you crazy after a while and make you jaded and stuff if you're constantly doing things that, you know, where you're trying to accommodate other people and not staying true to yourself. And ironically, the really funny thing is that it always seems to me that people respond the most when you're being the most honest,
yeah.
You know, when you're doing something that you know, you're being yourself. That's all anybody really wants an artist to be, you know. Yeah. I don't want to like go see a show by somebody that's playing songs that they think I want to hear, you know. I want to go see somebody that is, you know, being true to themselves and making the best music they can for, you know, their own worst critic. And that's always the best art, I think. So, yeah. So in a way it's like, you know, the music business sort of ate itself a little bit, but it's like, you know, it's good and bad. It's like, it is what it is. It's like, I'm trying to see the upside, to the way the business is now and just try to make it work, you know? And like you say, yeah, I like that actually, that, you know, making a living is a new success. I think so. I mean, if you're making a living, you're happy. What more can you ask for?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Tell me about the tone tips you do for Premier Guitar, which are very cool. I really enjoy them. So,
thanks.
Yeah. So, but it seems like you do it every month. But I take notice that there's sometimes you do a couple a month even. Is it just when you feel like doing
it? Once a month. No, it's once a month generally. And thanks for reminding me. I've actually got one due. I gotta get on that in the next few days here. It's column time.
Yeah.
I've just got back from Japan like about, I don't know, a week and a half ago. And still turned around. It's like, oh yeah, I've got a column to write. So tone tips. Well, it actually started out as me doing just an online column for them. That was a number of years ago, like, I don't know, maybe 2010 or 11, I started writing a column that was just in the online Premier edition, a blog. And that went really well. And after about a year or so, I felt like a little burned out. I was like, hey guys, I think I need to take a break. Like, I'm running out of ideas. And they said, oh, that's cool. No problem. And then maybe 6 months later, Tessa Jeffers, was my editor there. She hit me up and said, hey, I really like the blog you did. We've got this opening in the magazine now. Would you want to be a part of that and write a column every month? And I jumped on that because I was like, absolutely. I mean, I think Premier is one of the best, if not the best guitar magazine in the world out there right now.
Yeah.
So I was honored to be asked. And yeah, it's just such a, you know, it's a really quality publication. They're really forward thinking as far as, you know, the way that they set up their business so that you could read the magazine online and whatnot and also see it on the stands. And, you know, so I thought, yeah, I want to be a part of this. Now, it's funny because the column's called Tone Tips from the Road. And so it seems like, you know, it should be very technically based, you know, about gear and how to get sounds, and much of what I write is about that. But I also ended up getting very philosophical and just kind of career oriented and talking about, you know, your state of mind and, you know, I sort of addressing things like, you know, as kind of broad as is a career in guitar, you know, the right thing for you to consider or, you know, that kind of thing. Just sort of speaking from experience, like about the ups and the downsides of being a professional musician or dealing with things like stage fright or, things like this. So I write a lot about those things as well. And, they seem okay with that. You know, they always seem to be cool with me just kind of submitting what I want to submit. So it's really nice. It's fun. You know, it's a little hard every month to come up with an idea sometimes. And sometimes I'll just ask some friends like, hey, what would you want to, you know, see a column on? And something will click, a light bulb will go off. Somebody will say something. Oh, that's a great idea. And then I'm off and running. And I enjoy it. I like writing. And
Oh, you're a good writer, too. I enjoy reading you. You're, it's fun as compared to, you know, some writers, it's a struggle to get through. So, coming from a writer.
Yeah, I try to make it. Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate that coming from you. It's something I really enjoy, you know, just different side of creating, I guess, you know, it's also creative. So it's fun. So I'm kind of getting into doing things these days. I find where, you know, creative, but not necessarily, all about guitar or music, you know, coming from a slightly different place or, you know, another thing I got really into recently was starting to try and learn Japanese because I was over there so much, and it feels good to do things with your brain other than just play guitar and do music all the time. So that's something I'm trying to work on these days.
Well, you know, it's funny you're talking about the, you know, being on the internet and doing things, you know, with your YouTube channel and everything. And like I was saying, I really got into that, and then it took kind of a left turn where I had to get into internet marketing at the same time, and that meant Twitter ads and YouTube ads and Facebook ads and all sorts of things like that, you know, big email list and the whole thing. And it was the same thing. It was really fun because it was some new muscles that were being exercised. And even
I think it was
in music, but, you know, in a very remote sense, but still it was, and it's still a lot of fun to me. I must say, a lot of people, their eyes just glaze over, but for me, it's kind of cool.
That's great. I mean, it's fun to discover something that maybe you never thought would be interesting and say, I'm actually really enjoying this. But yeah I get that for sure.
Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever received or that you learned along the way?
Wow. I have to think about that for a minute. You know, right off the top of my head, I got to go all the way back to when, I was a kid and my parents were great parents and they, you know, were definitely, helpful to me with playing guitar and, you know, pursuing things that I wanted to pursue, but they were kind of more of the traditional mindset that, you know, I should go to college and, you know, they were scared of the prospect of me moving to Los Angeles and, you know, becoming a professional musician and whatnot, as parents should be, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I think in retrospect that was, I don't fault them for that at all. They were just one of the best for me. And it is a crazy, crazy, career path. But I remember kind of at some point sort of wavering in my, desire or my commitment to move and attend, when I first moved here, I went to GIT, I attended MI. So that was my goal at that point, that, you know, being a teenager, I was like, I'm moving down there and going to that school and, you know, kind of play guitar. And, at some point my dad's fears and, you know, his mindset had gotten through to me, and was affecting my decision. And I remember going to see my guitar teacher at the time. His name is Terry McDade, and we're still good friends. And he lives in Edmonton still, and is still a professional musician. And he was like a hero of mine, as well as a few other guys in that town. Because at the time, I mean, Edmonton's a little more, I guess, a little more cosmopolitan now, but it was a pretty blue collar place back then, and people sort of maybe couldn't see beyond like the traditional go to college, get a job, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That much. But there was a few guys in that town that were making a living as a musician, and they seemed, to be honest, like the happiest people to me that I knew. They were doing something that they loved, and they just seemed, you know, to be mellow people without a lot of stress in their lives. And I took note of that. So I was at Terry's, my guitar teacher's, his teaching studio one day, and I was telling him about my, you know, sort of my dilemma and feeling like, yeah, I think, I don't know. I think I'm just going to kind of maybe stay here. Maybe it's not the best idea. And he kind of looked at me and he just sort of said, you know, you're really, really good at this. And you should really consider that before you make this decision. He says, you know, he really believed in me. And he said, you should, you know, think about this a little bit more because I really think you could have a go at this. And that's all I really needed to hear at that moment. You know, there's these people that come along in your life and they can have a really big impact on you And on the course, you know, a lot of decisions are made in an instant, right? In a split second, and that can change the course of your life. But it just him believing in me enough to say, you know, you've got something special, and you should not give up on that and pursue it. Coming from a guy that was obviously happy and was making a living, even in kind of maybe the, you know, not adverse circumstances, but in a city like Edmonton where it wasn't, you know, like a music center or anything, yeah. But you know, he had his house, he had his students, and he played his gigs, and you know, they played out a lot, and he could play a gazillion different instruments, and he was somebody I greatly admired. So coming from him, that I just took that advice to heart, and that was it. I was off after that and moved to LA, and so I guess that was it, you know. And he was essentially saying, you know, I can tell that you've got a dream and what's in your heart, and you know that you should follow that. Don't compromise. So that's got to be it. You know?
So when you left there after he imparted that to you, was your mind mm-hmm. made up immediately?
I it's hard to say. It's so long ago. Yeah, I would say that just here, that when you asked me that question, that's the thing that popped into my head. So obviously that had a huge impact on me.
Yeah.
I don't think I was confused after that. You know, I think at that moment I just. When if this guy believes in me, then and I should give this the best shot that I can and follow through, you know. And I would say that was probably it at that point. I changed my mind again and decided I was going to go for it.
Follow your dream. It's always a good thing.
Yeah. Now make sure that it's for the right reason.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? Like make. I answered a question in my YouTube question and answer series in my last video that I put the other day. Somebody said, you know, asked me a question about being a musician and, had a career. And I said, you got to be crazy. Like, you got to be, it needs to own you. You got to think about nothing else 24/7 and just be like, of course. And there can't be a B plan or at least not in that moment. It needs to really own you, because there's going to be some hard times and there's going to be struggles. And, these days, especially, it's like you said, you know, the new success is making a living. So, you know, just expect that if you work your butt off and you're crazy about it and go for it as hard as you can, all you might get is hopefully you can make a living. You know, maybe something else will happen and you'll, you know, strike gold and become rich and famous. But that's really, you know, you got to do it for the love of the music and because you just can't think about anything else, because music and art is where it's at for you. And if that's the reason you're doing it, then I say go for it.
You know, I found a lot of musicians actually have several careers. And one is the first half of their life. And I mean, not simultaneously, although that happens a lot as well, but first half of their life, they're really hardcore into it. And then something kind of changes. And it might be mm-hmm. maybe there's a family all of a sudden, or it might be, you know, they just burn out on it. And all of a sudden, they're in another part of the industry, but they're in the music industry nonetheless. And the reason why I say that is
sure.
I'm sure you've run into a lot of people at different manufacturers. Most everybody that works in manufacturers is a musician. I'm always shocked at how great some of these people are. But I know them as, so-and-so, the salesman from this company. And then I find out the backstory. It's like, wow, you did that before? You know, I had no idea. And that's kind of cool as well. You know, it doesn't mean just because you make this decision, it doesn't mean that you're going to stay with it forever. It just means that this part of your life, you're doing it, and you better do it as good as you can, you know, while you're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think it does, you know, that's kind of happened with me. I mean, where I've gotten, you know, I make these videos and whatnot. And I'm an independent guy, but I've become also sort of ingrained in the musical instrument industry, I guess, in one shape or another. And who knows where that could lead. I think that the reason that people watch my videos on YouTube is because I actually have some sort of background. You know, I worked at Music Source and stuff like that when I was a kid. So I have some musical instrument sales, and I know how to kind of talk about equipment and distill things down, I think, in a simple fashion. And so that's a skill, you know, and I think that's what happens as many times. You're right. There's these guys that realize, hey, you know, maybe I don't want to tour my life away or whatever. And they see these other options and they can stay in the music industry, but it's not necessarily trying to, you know, tour their life away or, you know, be a performer or anything like that. And I think that's great. I mean, most of the guys I know, you're right. I mean, there's so many terrific players, you know, that work at these companies and obviously started out, you know, just for the love of playing and music. You know, many of the people I talk to on a daily basis are like that. Off the top of my head, I mean, I think of like, my buddy Rick Skillman, works at Celestion and, you know, he's a great guitar player and he lives in Austin now and he plays out all the time, plays in bands and stuff. But he works with Celestion, you know, he's a terrific example. So yeah, you know, it's not for everybody. I mean, to be honest, it's like part of what I do here and making videos and stuff and doing things like that is in an end goal or desire to not always have to take the next tour or the next, you know, paying gig. It's that I've got some control and maybe can stay in town and make some money because, you know, I'm mid-40s now and I don't have kids. You know, it would be something I would like to do. And, you know, it can become a difficult thing, you know, when you're on tour all the time to put that together. So I'm trying to find other ways to diversify and, you know, have some more stability and have a little bit more control, you know, beyond just always looking for the next touring gig so I can pay my bills.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, you're doing a good job. Yeah. You, everything that you're doing well, and that's the real secret. You know, it's coming from the right place. I can tell, you know, you're doing it because you're really passionate about it and you're as passionate about making the videos or writing your column as you are about playing.
Well, it seems that way. It's super fun.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. It's super fun. I mean, I get to sit there and talk, you know, I'm a total guitar geek and I think people get that it's authentic. You know, I'm not trying to sell anybody anything. It's just, if something sounds good, I plug it in and go, ah, cool. And then I write a song with it and go, okay, here's what this thing does. It sounds fun. Maybe you guys should check it out if you, you know,
yeah.
You know, and so it's, I feel like as long as I keep that up, you know, that's coming from a very honest place and I get to sit there and write songs and record them and play guitar and geek out on guitar gear and talk about it. So what's wrong with that? So it's very natural. It's like the same thing I've done since I was a little kid. You know, it's something I know how to do. And, yeah, I think that's the secret is like, kind of like, how can you, you know, find ways to, diversify and, you know, make a living in this crazy business and still keep it fun and keep it honest.
Yeah.
And it's totally possible. I mean, it's totally possible these days. It's, you know, you might have to throw 100 things at the wall and see what sticks, but some of them are going to, you know.
Well, I'm a good example. I stopped playing when I was in my mid 40s and I just went to the studio and kind of burned out on that. And it almost by accident, I got another, I can't say gig, it's kind of a minor career writing. I was writing for like a dozen different magazines. And then it turned into a book, the first book, and which turned into a second and a third. And next thing you know, it was 24. You know, and then
that's amazing.
And then it turned into courses, you know, video courses, and then you know, it's still kind of changing, but it's all. So I've come up with another career that's equally as fun. I still go in the studio. I still produce or mix, you know, one or two projects a year, but I pick and choose because I only want to work on stuff that's fun. If it's not fun, I don't want to do it. You know, I'm sure you know.
That's wonderful. I mean. That you figured out how to do that. And, you know, the beauty of doing what you're doing now is it's like, you don't need to be a certain, you know, like in fashion or a certain age or a certain, any, it's just knowledge and you can do that stuff forever. You know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think.
So what a really cool thing that you've been able to figure out a way to sort of transition into something that's, you know, you have a lot of control over, right? I mean, you know, you can probably work when you want to work and do the things that you want to do. And that's success to me.
Yeah, no, it's worked out okay. It took a long time to get there, but it's worked out okay.
Yeah.
So, hey, I have another last question for you. And I just thought of this. Because you're such a guitar geek, you have a perfect perspective on this. Where do you see electric guitar going in the future? And the reason why I ask is everything that we do in electric guitar is so much based on stuff that was designed 50 years ago or more. Do you see any big revolution or evolution either happening now or sometime in the future?
You know, it's hard to say. It's like, you know, the next great guitar player kid could come along and turn people onto the instrument, you know, and doing something that, that we can't even imagine right now. And it's, I feel like guitar is in a little bit of a lull right now. I mean, certainly, people are, you know, making music using iPads and doing different things. And kids are just interested in different stuff, and everything's vying for their attention these days too. So, you know, it's just a lot more fragmented. But once again, I think it's a matter of finding your tribe. You know, there's still tons of kids out there that want to play guitar and are enamored with it and whatnot, and get turned on by it. So I think, you know, the audience might be a little bit more fragmented or something these days, but there's still a desire out there. Now you see somebody like St. Vincent, you know, and she's like, you know, she's got to be turning on a ton of people onto guitar.
Yeah.
Just because she's a really cool guitar player and totally current and out there. And, you know, that's got to be having an effect on some kids, I would think, you know, in a way that, you know, the whole thing about it is I had a real respect for, all the blues greats and, you know, the older players and the origins of where things came from. Always I did, but it's really helpful if there's some younger people doing it too. Cause when you're a kid, it's really cool when you see somebody that's like maybe a little bit older than you or something that's doing it and they, you know, connect with you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you feel some sort of connection. Cause it's not just like, oh, that's my dad's music or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So that's a big part of it. So I love seeing somebody, like I say, like St. Vincent out there, that's like, wow, there's totally, you know, cool, unique perspective on guitar. She's a great guitar player. And, you know, that's just a really cool thing. So I think it's just a matter of that, of, you know, the other interesting thing is that, you know, more and more younger people that pick up a guitar, I don't think they care as much about the same things that we did, like when it comes to tone and, the tube amps and you need this vintage fuzz face or whatever. And it's got to be just like, so they don't care. They're like, pick up a guitar and plug it into their iPhone or their iPad or something, get some cool sound and be creative about it. And, you know, they're not so precious about, some are, you know, you see some young bands or whatever, they're just total aficionados for like vintage gear and analog recording and stuff like that. But for the most part, it's like, they don't care. They're happy to get sounds out of, it's just like how you see some people growing up these days producing music. Maybe they've never worked on an analog console.
Yeah.
You know, they're just making music, you know, they're making music using Pro Tools or whatever, but they're amazing. And it just doesn't matter, I don't think.
What do you see with gear? Do you see anything happening with gear that's moving ahead, that's changing?
Well, I mean, the whole industry's changed, right? I mean, with the way that, once again, this kind of comes back to what we were talking about with producing videos or music or whatever. I mean, everything's gotten put in the box, basically, and now you can come up with some pretty cool stuff that's, you know, that you could do on a laptop. So that's the biggest thing is, you know, I was reading an article with the guys from Failure, the band Failure, the other day. They just put out a new record, and those guys, they're touring, you know, using the Axe FX and stuff like that. And I was reading the article with I think it was the bass player and sometime guitar player in the band, Greg, was saying that, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, 15 years ago, people like engineers and stuff would just be complaining about plugins, saying, oh, it's not like using the analog stuff. And it's not, you know, but these days, all these years down the road, it's like, you got to kind of admit that it's like, you can do incredible things with plugins and that you don't necessarily need all that old stuff to get good sounds. I'm a total aficionado for old, you know, both guitar gear and recording stuff, but also I'm completely embracing the new stuff and realizing that at the end of the day, it's just whether or not it sounds good. You know, if the song's cool, and it moves you, it doesn't matter really how you got there.
Have you heard the Helix yet?
It's just stuff. So.
Have you heard the Helix?
Yeah, I have actually. I have checked out the Helix, the Line 6 Helix. Yeah, yeah. It's very cool. I was out there the other day actually looking at it. So that's a really cool piece of gear for sure. Also, just in the sense that they have gone deep into sort of the user-friendliness and ergonomic aspect of it. So they wanted to make it something that there might be a little bit of a learning curve, but really it's pretty intuitive.
Yeah.
So you think of a sound and you build it and bam, there it is. And I love that. You know, I think that's really cool. So I think they'll probably do really well. Well, with that.
It's funny. Yeah. I was, you know, I took their A/B test and that's online. Mm-hmm. And after a while I figured out almost every time I could pick the right one, I could pick the Helix out. But it wasn't for the reason everybody thinks. It was because it usually sounded better than the original one that was mic'd. I mean, it sounded better. It sounded
right.
You know, at which when you think about it, it's like, well, why would you want to go backwards if this sounds better in some sort of way, you know, and it fits better in the track, you know, why go to the
trouble? Absolutely. It just doesn't matter. You don't want to be too precious about anything, you know, as long as it should be at the end of the day, whatever sounds good. I'm a big fan of using impulse responses and load boxes for mic'd guitar cabinet sounds these days. So, you know, I've got heads in my studio and real amps and things like that. But as opposed to mic'ing a cab up and taking all that time and then needing to have a room to do that in and blasting away, you know, you can get these killer sounds out of guitar amps these days with just sort of simulating the back end of the rig.
Yeah.
You know, using a load box, loading it down to line level, taking that into your interface, and then using some really nice impulse responses of, and for those, you know, listening that don't know, an impulse response is basically like a sophisticated way of cabinet and speaker simulation. So, you're able to basically take a picture, a sonic picture of what a certain microphone or a group of microphones sounds like on a certain speaker in a speaker cabinet. You're able to, you know, put that into a file, put it in the box, and then load it up in your digital audio workstation and use that. So you can essentially duplicate the sounds of different speaker cabinets and mic combinations and very easily and quickly. So I love that because it sounds great to me and it's just so easy. So, I mean, it cuts out a lot of the hassle of recording. So, I'm, you know, all these things. Great tools, you know.
Yeah. By the way, your video on isolating the a guitar cab was very cool.
Oh, which one was that? Did I have a box that I built or something?
It was the plexiglass screens that you put around it, and then went on top.
Oh yeah.
As I remember, I reposted it on my blog. Yeah. It was so cool.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah, yeah. That's a product from a company called Clear Sonic that I've been using. They make these kind of plexiglass panels that go in front of a guitar amp or cabinet or completely surround it, and then you can put some panels on top. And it's not a total sound killer, but it knocks the volume way, way, way down and makes it you know, really easy to isolate a cabinet. There's also a really cool new product, actually, that I just did a video for called the SE Guitar F, which is like one of their microphone reflection filters.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put that in front of your cabinet and load microphones into it. And it's got a little bit of a kind of a filter that so it blocks sound from coming in the back. So that was another one I did recently on some guitar cabinet miking kind of stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
But yeah, so I still like miking cabinets and stuff. It's fun, you know, and I've got a room I can do it in right now at the studio space that I'm using. But it's time consuming, you know, so the impulse response thing is wonderful. I think if more people, I really need to do the ultimate sort of video on this subject, actually, where I show people, like, if I make an impulse response of a guitar cabinet, so I, you know, plug a guitar amp into a cab, mic it up, get a great sound, show what that sounds like, then I make an impulse response of that cabinet and basically put that sound in the box, and then I take the same head, plug it into a load box, and then run it through the impulse response, and then show the A/B of what it sounds like. I think people would be pretty blown away. I think it's something that not a lot of people have heard yet, but when they realize that it's like, oh my God, that sounds so close. It's basically splitting hairs. If not perfect. You know,
yeah. That'd be a great one.
No brainer.
Definitely.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Well, this has been very cool, Pete. Thanks so much for your time. We went a lot longer than, normally I'd go, but you're so interesting that, and you had the time.
Oh, thanks, Bobby.
So this has been great. I really enjoyed the chat.
Me too, man, and great chatting. We should do it again sometime for sure.
You can find out more about Pete at peterthorne.com. That's P-E-T-E-R-T-H-O-R-N, Peter Thorne, one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he helps put the show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.